Yeah, so I'm going to hold this presentation in English, first because I originally designed it for the user experience bar camp in Switzerland, and this is usually in English, and also because I was explicitly asked to keep it halted in English by one of our participants here. And my talk is about the brain is not a computer, so it's about distinguishing actually some misconceptions that are sometimes drawn when you are comparing computer architecture with the brain architecture, because they work in a completely different manner. And I'm drawing certain insights from neurology and from psychology into this. And I kept it focused on software design, so I try to make the connections why you should be knowing about this stuff, because obviously you're probably not the neuroscientists conference here, but more the hacker conference. So a bit about myself. My name is Pat. I originally studied computer science at the University of Basel. I did my master thesis there, and I'm currently switching my career towards user experience design. And I'm also active in internet, in technology politics, in net politics, yes. I was one of the co-founders of the International Association for the Pirates, and this presentation is a bit more critical about tech than you would usually expect, so you can always take this with a grain of salt. It's that way just in order to show you a different perspective and how you should probably connect those insights with your common conception about how technology works on us, or how you should use it, and how you should design your software for your users. So, but let's start with a personal story. So why did I get into this tech thing in the first place? So there was this cool series, I guess most of you will know it. So I was not interested in the David Hasselhoff guy that much, or in the car. I was never a car guy. But the thing that really got me interested there was the computer, because it was also cool. It was this self-thinking machine, and it could do so many things. And then I started telling my friends in kindergarten that I have not a brain, but a computer in my head. And I think that partially contributed to my exclusion there. I don't know why. It's really not that way. You have certain similarities, of course, because both are processing engines, both can store memory, but they work on a different kind of architecture. So you can Google up those difference tables on the net, and usually you don't get so much out of this, because they don't tell a story. They're just feature A versus feature B. But we probably start by this thing. So, hope it's getting better now. I'm not going into detail here, because I expect most of you to know what a computer is. You can have this very simple graphics which shows there is the system unit, and then there are the input and output devices, of course, and you usually refer to this as the computer if you're tech savvy, at least. And then you can go into the more conceptual part. Why is this not working? With the von Neumann architecture, for example. Who doesn't know this? Okay, so everyone is. So yeah, let's skip this part just. And I think I'm going to do this. You can go into all the details there, but let's focus on the other part. What is the brain actually? So what is the brain consisting of? Suggestions?
Mainly water. Mainly water.
Yeah, okay. But on a cellular level, you're right, of course. It's the neurons, and the neurons, they are those special brain cells. They have this thing, this is called the axon, and then there are the dendrites. Those are the receiving parts, so the input parts of the neuron, and the axon is like the output terminal of the neuron. And they are all interconnected. They are not connected like you connect tubes or so, because on the cellular level, they have this... On a cellular level, you have this gap, actually. So you have this gap between the connectors, between neurons, which is called a synapse. And why is there this gap? So why are they not grown together, those cells? Well, the main reason for this is that learning, and learning in a very broad sense, I mean, that's not like just learning math or anything, it's also just learning the persons in the room here, or learning what I'm telling you right now. Okay. In the brain happens by actually reconnecting those tubes. So, what happens here is basically that the dendrites and the axons, they grow together and they can be reconnected. Every day you go through, there multiple connections will be made between the neurons, and that's actually what the information architecture of the brain is based on. So if you want to learn something new, you are not growing new neurons. What you are doing is you are connecting your existing neurons together by those, in those synapses parts. And then we all have these nice abstractions of the brain, like this left-right hemisphere thing on a more top-based level on the brain, but it's not really that accurate, actually. It's more like a thing that you can refer to, but it's not really so scientific. So I'm just going to mention this to dispel some myths about common conceptions of the brain as well. So it's true that you have certain parts of the brain that are more specialized commonly, if you look on an overall population for certain tasks, but it's not like that you can't sometimes do the same task with a different part of your brain. So there are famous examples. For example, for once there was this lady from a monastery, a nun, and she actually was like 90 years old. She was a very well-functioning person. And when she died, she actually donated her brain for scientific research. And what they found was she had actually almost no brain. She had a very increased stage of Alzheimer's disease. But the reason that it stayed well intact was that she actually was a very active person. So she trained every day, she was physically active, she had many social contacts. And, well, obviously for her, all those abstractions with those centers or so, they are not that well matching. So if you see one of those graphics, it's more like general ID where it could be, but it's not like it has to be there. But what is there is usually that you have this bridge on your brain, so a mid of the brain, which is for sensing and moving your limbs, your face, your muscles, overall, and these are real. So if a certain part of your brain, for example, here gets damaged, then you more or less have problems with your face. So going back to the neurons and to the synapses, what we call what is happening when we do learning, in the very broad sense, is neuroplasticity. And this is actually controlled by this thing that is called BDNF, that's a brain development neurotrophic factor. That's a neurochemical that actually is relevant for making those synapses connect, so the connections for the learning in itself. And it also depends a lot what you do with your life, how well this works. Of course, you can have diseases, but there are certain things that increase or decrease your BDNF levels. Like for one is nutrition, one is for sleep, one is exercise, and stress is negatively affecting BDNF levels actually. So then there is also this model which I would like to discuss shortly, which is the trion brain model. I would like to refer to this because it's kind of important to know that there are kind of different working modes in the brain which are partially in connection with how we evolved as a species. So you have this reptilian or primitive brain, which is more like the very basic, where the basic feelings are, like hunger, thirst, sexual reproduction. Then we have this limbic or mammalian brain, which is more like for the feelings, and then we have this neocortex part, which is the thing that makes your brain so big compared to other species, which is relevant for all the abstract thinking. But just to say that it's an approximation, so it's not like the reptilians don't have also a kind of that neocortex part. They're just not well developed there. It's just for them, the lizard brain is mainly this brainstem thing, the cerebellum and the brainstem. So this is a nice representation where you can find those different aspects of your behavior expressed in the brain. And what you can see here is that obviously they somehow work together in your everyday life, but they are located in different parts of the brain and they may get in conflict. So it's a simplification, this model, especially the evolutionary aspect, as I said, but for the layman it's still a good approximation if you want to keep like a simple model of how the brain organizes certain aspects of your behavior. And now I'd like to go into the more psychological based aspects of this presentation, which is based on the research of one man. You just saw one thing. What did you see?
Angry woman.
Okay. What did you see?
Okay.
And if you would like to have an evaluation of those two things that you had to see, where do you think you need more effort to make an accurate description? Like you said, it's a multiplication, right? But if you would like to describe this to someone, it would take you a lot of effort to actually describe it, right? So to calculate it.
No, it's 17 multiplied by 24, mm-hmm. And I still don't know if that was a woman or a man.
Okay, no, but the point that I would like to make here is obviously if you want to interpret the image of a human face in what kind of emotional state it is, it is something that comes very natural to you. You don't usually have to have to put a lot of effort into this kind of thinking. And if you would like to evaluate this multiplication, you have to have some kind of concentration usually, if you're not like a hobby calculator guy who does all these things beforehand. So you can actually increase your speed for multiplications if you do them very often, but usually you don't, especially nowadays if you have calculators.
But you cannot compare both of them. I mean, if you ask me to describe this equation, well, I can just describe that, I don't need to calculate. This way, I don't need to calculate why the woman before that was angry. I just know that she's angry, and I just know that this multiplication. I don't need to calculate.
Yeah, but there was obviously a program in your brain that was happening, and yes. You realized, so this is an angry person that I saw.
Yeah, but I don't calculate why this angry.
No, that's true. That's true.
And the same here. I don't calculate for a result because it's useless to me.
Yeah, but if I had to ask you, then you would have to put a lot of effort into this.
Well, the interesting thing is that people notice that this is a multiplication, even though it was written there is 1 7 x 2 4.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true, actually. But that's not my point. No, the point is actually that there are obviously certain tasks that you can do very intuitively in a very fast way, and there are certain cognitive tasks that take a lot of your concentration and that you can't do, like when I would show another multiplication down here, like 33 times 10, you usually can't calculate those in parallel. You have to first calculate the first result, and then you have to calculate the second result. If I were to show you a slide like this one with two persons, and one was probably smiling and the other one was angry, this was a relatively effortless task. So there is this psychologist who was very famous for promoting this theory, who's called Daniel Kahneman, and this is the system one thinking, which is actually happening most of the time in your everyday life. It's like, you could say it's a little bit like a program you once wrote, and you can just run it through. You just wrote that program, and you have this interrupt in your perception that if phase run this program, and it just goes through. And then there are those tasks that are not possible to write in this programming language, like multiplication tasks. They usually, if you want to automate this task so that you're as fast as recognizing an angry or a happy person, it will take you a lot of time till you get that. And what we call this in the Kahneman theory is system two thinking. So that's That's the sequential system that takes a lot of effort, and this is system one thinking, which is like more heuristic-based approach, and which can do a lot of easy tasks very simply, very effortlessly, but also has its errors. Like I'm not sure if I have an example of that, but. You probably know this. You probably know the Lyell Müller graphic, which is a visual riddle. So you have automatic system one thinking program. So to recap, why do we have this system one and system two thinking? Well. This probably summarizes it on a more philosophical level, but it has some truth into it. Because what you have to know is that your brain is actually a very energy intensive organ. So like about 30% of the energy you consume from food goes into your brain, and compared to its size to the rest of the body, that's a lot of energy that is going into there. And if you want to have like really this critical system two thinking, then you have to invest a lot of energy So that's why we have this this simple system one thinking system, which actually makes it effortlessly to like use heuristic approaches to our encounters in everyday life, but it is error prone and it uses less energy than the other system, and it can be, moreover, it is usually easy to run several system one thinking parts in parallel. So if you're a person who is probably who likes biking and who likes to listening to music, you can usually do both of these at the same time, although they usually would, if you would have to have them like really critical, think, what do I have to do with my steering wheel? How should I interpret this symphony in the music that I'm listening to? This wouldn't work out. You would be in constant conflict with this sequential thinking that you know from the system through thinking. Okay. So to summarize, system one is for this intuition instinct part. It makes about 95% of your everyday thinking, and it is usually on an unconscious level. So it's also the part that probably makes you want to say fuck off to someone if you're really angry at them. And system two thinking is more the part that makes it, that makes you a bit more, that says, okay, you probably shouldn't offend this person in this situation because it's in your office and it's not your close friend or whatever. It overrides the other system. It can make very critical choices. It can make very deep thoughts, but it takes also a lot of energy and a lot of time, and it's only in a sequential mode. Yeah, that's what I said about the brain's energy needs. Now, there is something similar concerning memory in the brain. When you... we have this experiment, which is actually concerning pain intensity. Now, here, these were from a colonoscopy execution, so where you have to put the tube into your butt, and then they are actually looking at your inner organs. And this was from the 70s, when this procedure was very pain intensive. And what you see here on those graphs is, first there's this pain intensity scale. So this represents how intensive the pain was, and this is actually the time dimension. So obviously patient A had a much shorter colonoscopy than patient B, and on the peaks they were about the same. Now, when you are going to compare these two persons afterwards, if you ask them, how did the colonoscopy feel? How terrible was it for you? How would you evaluate the pain you experienced during the period from on a scale from 0 to 10? What happens, surprisingly, is that patient B says, "Oh, it wasn't that bad." And patient A says, "Oh, it was terrible." And the reason for this is that, in contrast to patient B, there is no decline. There is a really sharp cut after the colonoscopy pain intensity. So this one takes a lot more time. And overall, you would say, "Okay, this patient obviously had no more pain." If you make it on an integrational level, if you calculate pain on an integrational level. But if you ask them afterwards what was more painful, well, patient A will say, "Oh, it was the most painful experience I ever had." So what this shows is that there is not only this system 1 and system 2 thinking separation in your brain, but there is also separation between an experiencing self and the remembering self. The experiencing self is the one that is associated with system 1, that is the current thing, like the thing you right now experience. So it's more like on a 3-second scale or something like that, not like on a yearly or weekly or whatever scale. And the remembering self is actually that part of your memory which you can look up to, which is associated with system 2. So if you have to make an evaluation based on past experiences, how should I react to this? You are actually going into that remembering self mode and you are looking up things on your hard disk, more or less. And one thing that I mentioned at the UX campus, obviously if you want to have good ratings for your software, you probably should have, if it's badly designed, you should at least give them a good outgoing experience so they remember it as being a good software. We can also, like I said, we can program system 1 thinking with system 2 thinking, and we can like automate certain tasks by that behavior. Or what we also can do, we can also automate tasks by external tools, and that's where I'm going to head next. So this is also like where it is a philosophical quote. But this was actually a British mathematician, so it's not so philosophically. You can think of the advancement of civilization by the number of things you don't have to actively think about. So the less you have to use that very thoughtful thinking, or the less you have to think, okay, I'm having this conference next week, you just put it into calendar and then it's done for you, right? So you can do more stuff on that level, but it comes with a price. And I'm going to add to what this price is. But first, I'm going to go for something completely different. Who knows this hashtag? No, I guess. So now, I did this at the UX camp, the user experience bar camp in Switzerland first, and they all know this hashtag more or less. It's actually the World User Experience Day. And of course, that's the year World User Experience Day. And every year they have like a topic which is the center of all the conferences that are happening around the world at this day. It's always in autumn, in October, I think. And the topic for this year is UX design for good or evil. So I thought about this topic a lot, and what I came up with concerning system design or software design were like, if I think about the evil, okay, we all would like to think about us UX designers or software developers as the good guys usually. We are not the persons that want to be bad. But sometimes bad stuff happens. And what are like the archetypes of bad stuff that happens? Now, first we probably have this very archetypical computer guy who knows nothing about good software design, who is probably throwing too much information at the people, who probably designs the system just by the database connections that is shown, that he has seen in the entity relationship model, and they are probably just ignorant why, if you have a missile alert system which alerts all the people about there are missiles probably going to going down now in your area, you should get into cover, why you should really distinguish between the mode that is the testing mode and the one that is actually the real mode, so you don't sound the wrong alarm. This is what I call the ugly. Then there is this archetypical bad designer who is really just there for all the selfish gain, so he probably like puts like something that that looks like dirt on an ad. So if you are if you're seeing that ad and you think it's dirt on my smartphone, I'm going to tap on this, and then you are actually clicking the ad. And There are actually designs that are like that. If you are interested in this, if you want to be like the dark software designer, you can Google for dark patterns. There's a whole library about design that is actually just in there for encouraging people to go after business interests of others, not for their self-interests, like like making forced choices that you don't want to make. Like a good example is adding a countdown timer for an ordering system, as if there were a limited amount of items you could order and they're going out, and when you refresh the page it's all just again the same counter, but because you put pressure on the people, they obviously are going more after that. And the good one, that's actually the Anakin guy. That's probably the guy who thinks, I'm doing very good stuff, I actually want to make the world a better place, but in the end, he ends up serving evil. And I think we see a lot of this nowadays a bit, because... let's go back to the World User Experience Day 2014. There the topic was engaged for engagement, and if you think about engagement, yes, sorry?
Why are you showing hashtags but not a photo of this event?
Ah, because the event is happening all around the world, so...
But it would be much easier for us to, well, comprehend it in system one thing.
Yeah, okay. That's true. Thanks for... If I'm doing this another time, I'll add this.
This is a very important factor, is that for this case, you actually want us to be in system two thinking, right?
Yeah,
true. This is another comment. You did this.
Good comment. Now there was the topic engage for engagement, and if you think about engagement, it's usually that thing people are hooked to your app, to your website. They are constantly refreshing it for whatever reason, like they are on Facebook and they want to see all the new stuff that is happening around there. And engaging design actually can be mostly addictive design, and this works because this works because it's basically more or less like a slot machine. Like you even have this lever mechanism, like in a slot machine, with the refresh, pull down to refresh mechanism, and the algorithms that are running behind that are actually designed in a way so that you will get always kind of posts that are matching your personal profile and always new content, even if there is not real new content. So sometimes if you do this refresh action, Facebook actually just looks up what is the next thing that I haven't shown that person, probably like, okay, tomorrow those close friends are going to that event, I haven't shown that as a notification to the user now, so I can reshow it to the user again as a new as if it was a new notification. It's not really something that was newly happening, that actually triggers that reward system you have in your limbic system, in your lizard brain, which says, oh, there's something new, something interesting that I can learn. And I think I really got the slides out of order somehow, sorry. That was another thing about the system two thing that I had for the UX designers, because lots of them haven't even been into deep programming, and it's a really good visualization why you shouldn't interrupt people while they are coding a very complex system. You probably know this as the sawtooth effect. So if you have to concentrate on a task in a very deep manner, like it's common in programming, where you really have to steer up your system through thinking, and you are getting interrupted, it takes you a lot of time to get back to that point where you actually were. And this also has a bit of an effect if you think about behavior changes that come along with all these artificial notifications. So if you are probably trying to follow this lecture more or less, and or some boring university lecture, and then there is always your phone coming up with new notifications. This actually interrupts your thinking process. You're resistant to thinking, and you're back at square one, where you once was. That's also part of the problem that comes with automatic certain parts of with technology of your life. So sometimes you are actually losing skills by using technology because you simply don't use that part, you simply don't train that part of your brain, because your brain is not only the processor, it's not only the CPU, it's also the memory. It's the same thing that actually executes all this, those programs that are running in the background. So if you're if you never train remembering phone numbers because you have this app that does it for you, then you're not training that part of the brain, and probably remembering phone numbers is not such an important skill. But what is probably an important skill is like interacting with people, and if you're constantly sitting in front of a screen, you're actually not training those parts of your brain. So that's why I also included the slide previously about subjective well-being. This study with Facebook data, before there was Cambridge Analytica, they got a lot of data out of the system and analyzed behaviors of youth to what extent they were depressive, and they found that if they used Facebook in a very intense way, then they were more likely to be depressive. And part of the reason why this is that they were also not using those parts of the brain that were actually associated with social interaction. Because if I talk to you, then we have very direct conversation. But if you are just in front of the screen, you're actually using way less of your abilities. You don't have to interpret all those emotions in people, you don't have to act immediately, you don't have just to use certain skills that you were finding in the brain. And well, if you go back to the Stone Age, it was also very bad if you were somewhere alone without your peers somewhere in the wild. Then it would be a good thing to feel bad, but nowadays this fires back to you because your brain actually tells you, well, I'm feeling lonely, although you don't probably feel like that. But the reason for this is basically just that you are not using those parts of your brain that are associated with interacting with people and that are way more complex. And this is also where all this digital dementia stuff is partially coming from. I don't know who knows the term. Yeah, more or less. So we can talk a lot about if there is really this thing, if it's like if there is on a scientific scale real digital dementia, but there is certainly a phenomenon. There are several phenomena that you can summarize under this term, like you could like environment. Do with environmental protection, and it's not just pure thin air that is there, but you can actually use your brain, underuse your brain if you just automate certain tasks, if you're excessively using certain platforms that are understimulating it, that are not draining certain parts of your brain. And Part of the problem is not only that this is on a behavioral level when you're attached to the screen and you're just doing this slot machine mechanism, but that there is also a lower BDNF level. So if you are constantly using Facebook all the time, you're probably not going for a healthy nutrition. You're certainly not getting enough sleep because you're constantly hooked to your smartphone, refreshing your social pages that's designed by an algorithm, and you're probably not getting enough exercise. And you were also probably getting a lot of chronic stress. So for once, there was a study, which they faked, as they do a lot in psychological studies, where the participants had to indicate their phone number before the experiment, and then there was a really boring experiment, but the point was they actually told them that they had to put away their smartphone, and they measured their stress levels on skin with a skin measuring device, you can do that. And every time they texted them, their stress level increased. So every time there is an automatic algorithm that tells you, oh, there is a new notification, you should probably should look at that, your stress level increases. And this overall leads to lower BDNF levels, which again is bad for learning. So in summary, you can argue that there is something you should care about when talking about the brain concerning using digital devices. And what are the alternatives to this? Well, there was this guy, or there is this guy, who is a former design ethicist from Google. His name is Tristan Harris. He also has a lot of talks online, like a TED talk, and there is a Vox video and such, which actually says the way we currently design technology is probably detrimental for us as a species if we are just hooking people to follow the needs of a business. So Facebook basically works because you keep getting hooked to it, and advertisers pay for showing their advertisement to you. So the more Facebook can keep you hooked, the more they earn money. And if you really want to change that way, you have to design software differently. You should get away from all those addictive design patterns that are more or less slot machine-like behavior. And there is this initiative that is called they had a very number of names. Previously it was Time Well Spent, now it's the Center for Human Technology, which actually says, okay, we probably have to go more on like the same level as we do with food when it comes to organic food. So there is a different quality if you want to actually design software that supports the goals of your use, probably also damaging part of your well-being and your cognitive skills. So take home messages from this talk. It doesn't work like a computer, it's very different. There are constantly new connections that are on those synapses that actually allow for learning. There is this overlap between CPU and memory in the brain that doesn't make it the same as in a computer architecture in classical. There are those two kinds of thinking where the very slow rational thinking can also automate some of those heuristic thinking, system one, which actually makes up most of your everyday behavior. There is this experiencing self and the remembering self. The brain probably hasn't evolutionary adapted to high tech over those years that we are using it currently, and this has some implications for software design as well, because it may, if software is designed in a bad way, it may negatively affect you on a psychological or neurological health level. And engaging design is, you often act just addictive design. It's not per se always supporting the goals you probably have when you would like to say, okay, probably I'm going to die tomorrow. What do I want to achieve till I die tomorrow? Yeah, so like, it's just probably keeping you hooked in an artificial way for business gains, and you probably should consider, you just have to be aware if you're designing software, you are impacting the world. The question is not whether you do this, but the hard question is, how might we change this for the better for our species? Thank you. Questions? Yeah?
Can you go back to a few slides there? Yes, the slide. So the way I'm seeing this is that, well, computer is, a brain is not a computer, and the tech companies realize that and they go into all this engaging design and tracks. So the takeaway is, if you make a user interface, please make it, please assume that a brain is a computer and you will not do any fine engaging this design. Just simply assume your target is a computer. And well, it works, and then it automatically also puts your brain into system two, and well, everybody's happy.
Okay, you could ask, you could go for that, but probably you're not going to have a lot of users.
Yeah, that's the issue.
No, probably. What I would like to summarize is that you can actually design technology that is beneficial for humans, but you have to really consider what kind of implications your design has on an overall level and what you want to achieve with that, because you often end up with a design that is probably good to trick your brain, but not good for the individual that is tricked.
Well, I think most of us here come from the Unix world, and it was more or less not as addictive.
it certainly has its ups. So, yeah. Like what I didn't show there, I have some backup slides. There is also this idea of complementary versus competitive cognitive artifacts, or you could also replace cognitive artifacts with tech tools. So there are certain tasks that you probably want to externalize because you can't do them. You don't want to like switch the bits on the computer memory by hand and tracing bugs, because it's a very stupid thing for a human to do because you don't want to operate on that level. So you are externalizing certain words, and I think when it comes to the Unix world, you have a lot of those small commands that actually automate them for you. And then there are those competitive cognitive artifacts which are actually taking away certain parts of the training that you are doing for your brain every day, like remembering where exactly is the place I'm going to. If I'm using GPS all the time, I will get better, I will get worse at navigating around cities, because I just don't train the part of the brain, so it's actually a competitive cognitive artifact. And but if I just use the GPS to show me where I am, then it's a complementary, because that's obviously something we can't do with the natural skills we have as a human. So like the location part of GPS is like the complementary part, and the part where you tell the computer, okay, please navigate me to this and this place, that's the competitive part, where you don't actually have to think about where you are actually having to.
But here the question is whether navigating is a useful thing for humans.
That's true. We can debate this all night long, because obviously most of us don't have a clue how to grow crops in the field nowadays, or they don't have a clue how to catch and slaughter an animal for food, because we externalize those tasks to specialized persons for that, and that's kind of the trade-off you have to deal with. But you also have to realize that if you are externalizing a lot of this, and if you are keeping people just hooked to the computer screen for your economical gains, then you're probably not advancing the species, but you're actually making them dependent on you, and that's probably not something you want to have to. Yeah. Other questions?
I would be very interested in long-term effects of, let's say, Facebook.
Yeah, there are studies that try to evaluate this, but it's a very new field, so it's not really like established knowledge. That's what makes it kind of difficult to evaluate, and that's also where you have this like kind of fights between certain people, like the digital dementia term that's actually coming from a scientist from South Korea, because they're using a lot of technology and was popularized by Manfred Spitzer in Germany, and who is often attacked because he's seen as having very extreme views. But he's actually a renowned scientist, and I think it should be a matter of debate because he cites a lot of studies that are actually showing that use of technology can be detrimental for you as an individual. So,
no, but think not with a short term. Like, we use Facebook, we got number, we lost technology. Think long term. And like in 10 years, people will start, well, even now, people will start to realize that Facebook is doing this to them.
Yeah.
They might, well, no, I don't want to depress. So he shuts down the Facebook and goes outside, and then he just develops a very good survival strategy of avoiding this addiction
behavior. Yes, of course. If you are aware of those tricks that can be played on your mind, then obviously you're also more immune to them, because you are aware that they are trying to do this.
Not necessarily. I mean, we still have cigarettes.
Yeah, but the decline in cigarette smokers is...
But are you sure that's because people know how addiction works and what the health effects are? Or is it just, well, again, user experience design, upping the price and plain packaging laws or having warning labels on the package? Do you think people stop smoking because they're aware smoking is dangerous? Or is it everything else that has happened around cigarettes? Or just, for example, make it inconvenient by it's no longer socially acceptable to smoke indoors and so on and so on. I don't really see any evidence for people stopping to smoke because they've been made aware of it's dangerous per se.
Yes, that's true. That's true for a lot of other bad behaviors because, for example, alcoholics usually know that drinking alcohol in excess is not a good thing for their bodies or their brains, and they're not acting accordingly, and that's usually stemming from the separation of thinking, I think, from this heuristic and this rational thinking part, because this complex information that smoking or drinking or excessive use of this or that is bad is in conflict with what your heuristical limbic system actually wants. It's that reward system that's sitting there, and you have to make the connections between them and weigh them down and make the decision, okay, I actually don't want to do this. Like, same thing as, okay, I'm in office, I shouldn't call this guy an asshole because I'm damaging my opportunities to work again with this person in the future. So, yeah, you have to make a deliberate choice about this.
Well, one comment is the big difference between alcohol and cigarettes is that alcohol is basically in system 2 thinking. So we know that it harms us, but I mean, we take a bottle and it's very cute and there's some paper on it, and there's no pictures of dead babies. And while on cigarettes, you take a package and there's like some guy with lung cancer on it. And then this is a warning, this is not even just a warning, it's not logical, it's system 1 warning, it tells us, it's repeated, and as you can see, like, there is almost no smokers at this event. The smoking has declined incredibly hard in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, like, everyone was smoking, as far as I remember. Now we have much less smokers. Drinking's still the same.
Yeah, because it goes down into this basic level of your brain. It's getting into the blindest, in this emotional brain activity where you say, oh, that's bad, actually, I should probably stop that, and you're not just reading a headline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What do you recommend for parents?
For parents, I'd recommend to limit the time you expose your child to technology, and you should make deliberate choices about what kind of technology you want to encourage children to use. So, I'm not, like, you can argue all, if you read this book, you will basically read you have to be very careful, you should be very restrictive, because it shows that this study, every time a child got a laptop, their learning abilities decreased in school and such. And I can't give you a definitive advice there, but there are certain mechanisms you can put in place to probably not make it that bad.
Actually, at age 12, they have a smartphone. At age 12 or 10, they all have a smartphone, and it's their own. It's kind of hard to.
So I think the best solution is not to restrict. But the best solution is just have a talk with your child, show him to Android Studio, and show him how to make apps, and then explain, well, if you put this red flashing button and the rest of your team is blue, then people will get attracted to this red button. And then slowly you will nurture understanding of all these things, and I think this would be a good better way forward.
Or probably consider suggesting adding a time usage tracker to your child, because then they know how much time they are spending on Facebook and how much time they are spending elsewhere. I mean, you don't even have to use an app. You can just tell them. I mean, I had this in school. We had one teacher that told us more or less we should just track our time we use every day for stuff, and then we have a better understanding, because we are more aware of how much we do this and this. And I think it's the same with kind of addictive behavior everywhere. If you are aware that you're probably not just drinking a beer once a week, but you're actually aware, okay, I'm having a beer for morning, and then two for lunch, and two for dinner, I'm actually drinking five beers every day, then at least you can reason about that. And then there are also apps that can actually elevate some of the effects that are actually stemming from this slot machine behavior. Like Windows recently introduced a new feature that was called Focus or Attention. I don't know the name anymore, but I read this on the Human Tech List. There is this. There is a similar app for one of the mobile phones, but I'm not sure if it was Android or. I think it was Android. Yeah, there is an Android app definitely that helps you keeping away all those distracting notifications. Like one thing you can also do is like saying, okay, I just don't want to have notifications all the day through, but just at certain time slots. So I'm having a focused experience with my social networks, and I'm not going to just having to use social networks all day long and not getting into the really concentrated thinking. I don't know if you're happy with the answer.
Yeah. Well, I tried several rules, strategies, and they always seem to work sometimes, but
not all the time.
The usual trick might be gamification always works. Strict rules, of course, will not be followed, but if you make an achievement out of it, then of course it's interesting.
Yeah. True, yeah.
And I'll teach your kid how to Unix, and he will never be the same again. Because one comment is that if you restrict something, you make it more attractive to the person.
Strong on the child.
And I think it's like forbidden fruit is always the tastiest.
And there is also social pressure, of course. That's also an external factor that is hard to change.
And in the class chat, they have 500 messages a day.
Whoa!
That's crazy. It's fucking crazy.
But are they meeting people sometimes?
Yeah, they're meeting all the time. But the chat, the WhatsApp chat,
it's full of messages.
It's insanity.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have a definitive answer, so the only thing that I could suggest is heading to one of those two. Like I said, the digital dementia, some people say it's bit over the top of the fear-mongering that Manfred Spitzer is advocating. I think you should at least evaluate what he's saying, because he is a renowned scientist, and take it probably with a grain of salt. And then there's this group for the Center for Human Technology by Tristan Harris that is considering pushing for more sensitive use of technology in our everyday lives and for more sensitive design of software overall. And they are also referencing like these new focus apps and such, but I don't have a definitive answer. So. Further questions? Okay, then thank you again for your attention. I hope you learned something and had a good experience.